Newman found the three security officers standing along the wall behind four men and one woman, who sat on sofas and chairs. These five were all Caucasian. They looked straight at her as she entered the room, their faces illuminated by candlelight. Even in the amber glow, Martell saw the apprehension in their eyes. She felt obligated to make some remarks to calm the group down. In English, she said, "Everything is in order. I am waiting for a visitor to arrive, and then we will proceed." Before anyone spoke, there was a knock at the front door. The three security men looked up and started toward the entryway, but Martell waved them back into their places and went herself. She opened the door to find a man in a black motorcycle jacket. He was Asian. She assumed he was North Korean like the others, but she sure as hell was not going to ask. The man carried a folder in his hand. He held it out and said, "You saw no one." She took the folder. "You already asked me this. What is wrong? What happened?" She looked past him and into the parking circle. Two men sat in the rain on motorcycles. A third bike, presumably belonging to the man in front of her, was parked alongside them. The North Korean stepped into the entryway and shut the door. "The American had men with him. We were not notified of this." "Nor was I. As I said before, it wasn't my job to identify surveillance." The man did not seem satisfied with her answer, so she added, "Call New York if you'd like to make a complaint about my performance." The North Korean's nostrils flared. Martell presumed he wasn't accustomed to being spoken to like this, but she couldn't care less. She ignored the man's glare and began looking through the folder. Inside, she found five smaller manila folders. Opening them one at a time, she fanned through five complete sets of documents. EU diplomatic passports, Czech diplomatic assignments to Pyongyang, credit cards bound with rubber bands. She returned to the living room. The North Korean in the black jacket followed behind. Veronica looked at the photo page of each passport and each visa, and she took her time to match the documents to the five sitting in front of her. They sat quietly, nervously waiting for her to say something, but she did not rush herself. All the documents looked perfect, except for the last of the passports. The cover appeared to be stained with red ink. Martell ran a thumb over the embossed cover, and she realized the color was no stain, as it came off easily. Looking at her thumb, she saw it was fresh blood. "Mon Dieu," she said to herself. "These men had taken these by force from the American agent." She glanced up at the North Korean. His eyes remained on her. Surely he had seen her notice the blood. She thought he was enjoying her discomfort. "Everything is in order," Veronica Martell said. The North Korean left without another word, and within moments she heard three motorcycles firing up and driving off. Martell put the documents on a table and moved a lamp closer. To the entire group, she said, "Your flight leaves at 9:30 a.m., arriving in Pyongyang at 11:35. I'll go over your legends with each of you, and then you should try to get a few hours' sleep. I will wake everyone at 6. The one other female in the house, a redhead in her 40s, stood up from the sofa and approached. Her Australian accent was obvious. "Would you mind if I spoke to you in private?" Veronica Martell just shrugged and moved into the kitchen. The woman followed. She was much shorter and a little heavier than Martell, and the lighting here did her no favors. Martell thought the redhead looked as if she hadn't slept in days. It had been rough for all five of the Australians she knew, as she had been with them all week. The French intelligence agent said, "What can I do for you, Dr. Powers?" The Australian closed the door all the way. She spoke softly. "Look, we agreed to come. The money was incredible, obviously, but it seemed like an adventure, you know. What is your question?" "I left a family behind back in Sydney. 6 months' work and I'm back home. That's what was agreed on. Martell put a hand out on the counter, strummed her perfect nails on the tiled surface. Dr. Powers continued, I just want to make sure the terms promised me are honored. Martell made no attempt to whisper. Dr. Powers, my job is to facilitate your clandestine travel safely from Sydney to Pyongyang. Nothing more. Whatever agreement you have with the DPRK, it is between yourself and the DPRK. Powers looked to the door to the living room nervously. I don't trust them. They watch over us like we're prisoners. They won't answer my questions. I just thought, you are working with them. Can you help me? Maybe just ask them to be a little more forthcoming about the arrangements in place. Please? Martell took her hand from the counter next to her and placed it on the smaller woman's shoulder. With a little smile, she said, Doctor, I understand. The older redhead looked relieved. I know you would. I understand that the fact I am female and I have round eyes to you means I should be more sympathetic than the North Korean men acting as security here. But nothing could be further from the truth. They have use for you. I do not. She lowered her hand and headed for the door. When you get to Pyongyang, I'm sure your concerns will be alleviated. Powers all but shouted, Do you have any idea how ridiculous that statement sounds? Martell was unfazed by the redhead's anger. I didn't agree to work for the North Koreans. You did. Your decision is made, and you would do well to make peace with that decision, because they are not going to allow you to change your mind at this juncture. She returned to the living room without another word. As she passed out the documents and went over the individual legends for each of the five, she let herself wonder what would happen to these Australians. Working with the North Koreans certainly would be fraught with legitimate concern, but she expected all five of them to fulfill their contract with Pyongyang and to return home much wealthier than when they left. It was, of course, illegal work, and they were being paid with this in mind. Martell knew very little about what these five would be doing for North Korea, but even so, she wasn't worried about this operation from any sort of a moral standpoint. It wasn't as if these people were nuclear scientists or rocket scientists. They were geologists, that was all. No threat to anyone, certainly, even if they were working for the North Koreans. No. This was just some industrial, commercial, and diplomatic subterfuge. Nothing dangerous. And then she paused for a moment, thinking about the blood on the passport, and the annoying American who had no doubt shed it. If the North Koreans were willing to use violence in a foreign nation to secure the travel of these geologists, perhaps the stakes were higher than she thought. She pushed the misgivings out of her mind, a skill she had developed and honed over her intelligence career. Right now, she just wanted to get these five on the 9:30 flight tomorrow morning to Pyongyang to sanitize the safe house, and then to go home. Nothing else mattered to Veronica Martell. Chapter 5 The dented gray sedan carrying the four campus operators and the body of ex-CIA officer Colin Hazelton pulled into the hangar of the fixed base operator at the far east end of Tan Son Nhat Airport just after 1 a.m. The sole aircraft in the hangar, a sleek white Gulfstream G550, had already been unplugged from its APU by the ground crew, who had conspicuously disappeared as the car approached the loading stairs. As the men climbed out of the vehicle, an attractive woman stepped out of the office of the fixed base operator. Her blonde hair was pulled into a neat bun, and her generic flight attendant's uniform was perfectly pressed. Adara Sherman was officially the flight coordinator for the campus G-550, but this was just one of her many duties. She also provided security to the aircraft, organized every bit of travel for the operators in her organization, dealt with customs issues, and performed other duties as required. Clark stepped up to Sherman as soon as he climbed out from behind the wheel. "Good to see you again."
"You too, Mr. Clark."
"What's the situation?"
"We're fine. Customs is dealt with. The ground crew and office personnel are giving us some space."
"I assume that cost a small fortune."
"Discretion comes cheaper here than in some other places. Can I help with the body?"
"We'll handle him. Just let the flight crew know we needed to be out of the country an hour ago, so anything they can do to expedite will be appreciated."
Sherman headed for the stairs.
Driscoll and Ryan carried the body of Colin Hazelton onto the plane, while Clark and Chavez stood guard at the entrance to the hangar, making sure no personnel from the FBO or the airport made the mistake of taking a peek into the hangar during this critical moment of exposure. Adara had already placed a body bag on the floor of the cabin. The presence of several ready-to-go body bags in the cargo hold of the G-550 was a grim reminder to the operators of the campus that the work they did was high stakes. But this was the first time one of the bags had been put to use. Hazelton's body was zipped inside, then he was placed into a hidden compartment built between the rear bulkhead and the cargo hold. It was specifically designed to hide a full-sized man, but it was just barely large enough for this role. Each of the operators had tested it out, and it had even been used operationally to hide one of the men during immigration and customs inspections. All agreed that the person who customized the compartment had done so with no plans to put it to personal use. Hazelton had no complaints, however. When all were on board and the hatch sealed, the pilots began taxiing toward the tarmac. Slowly at first, but soon they began expediting their departure off the nearly empty runway, and they were airborne in minutes. Shortly after leveling off, Adara served the men coffee, juice, and water. Clark sat alone up at the bulkhead, and here he called Jerry Hendley, the director of the campus and the owner of the jet. While he drank coffee, Clark carefully filled him in on everything that had happened. Soon the entire team converged around the teak table in the center of the aircraft, and together they inspected the note Colin Hazelton had scribbled seconds before succumbing to his wounds. Both Clark and Chavez wore reading glasses, but even with their corrected vision, it was hard to make out the writing. It was clear there were only four words in total on the page, one word alone, and then below it, two more. Then at the bottom, four more letters had been scribbled, badly, almost one on top of the other. The wide blood smear across the chicken scratch only added to the difficulty of discerning Hazelton's penmanship. Chavez said, "The first word is four letters, but it's completely obscured by the blood. Not a clue. Below it, there are two words. The first one looks like... is that scata?" Clark said, "That means shit in Greek."
"You speak Greek?"
Ryan asked, surprised. "No, but I had Greeks working for me in Rainbow. Working for me causes a man to cuss, I guess. I heard that one a lot." Driscoll turned the sheet his way to look it over, and he leaned even closer. "It's not scata. I think it's scala." After everyone looked again, Chavez and Ryan agreed with Driscoll, and Clark gave in to majority rule. "Okay, scala. Sounds like a proper name. Central European, maybe?" Ryan was already at his laptop Googling the word while Adara Sherman refilled his bone china coffee cup next to him. With excitement, he said, "Got it. It's a town in Poland." Then, with a voice less enthusiastic, "Wait, it's also a town in Bulgaria."
"Shit. There's one in Ukraine, too. Another in the Faroe Islands."
Driscoll mumbled, "Well, damn. That's not very helpful." Chavez said, "It might be a person as well. I knew a Hungarian army captain with that surname back in CIA. He died in a helo crash 15 years ago, though. Clark, you know anybody named Scala?"
Clark shook his head. He was concentrating on the next word now. What's that? Four letters? Looks like IATA. All caps.
Ryan googled that as well. International Air Transport Association.
Might just be a coincidence.
Sherman was pouring orange juice for Chavez. She hadn't said a word during the conversation, because no one had asked her opinion. But she glanced at the page and said, Prague.
The four men turned to look up at her, so she clarified.
Sorry, it's the ICAO airport code. That's Václav Havel in Prague, Czech Republic.
Ding said, I thought the Prague airport code was PRG.
Sherman smiled. You are thinking of the IATA code. That's used commercially, what you see on your ticket or when you book a flight. The ICAO is what pilots use.
Ding looked at her doubtfully, but Clark buttressed her claim.
Hazelton was a pilot. He was ex-Air Force and held a multi-engine private pilot's license.
Ryan said, Scala could be a Czech name.
Maybe if we go to Václav Havel Airport in Prague and start looking around for a guy named Scala, we'll get lucky.
Clark said, For now, we're heading back to D.C. The first item on our agenda after returning is to sit down with a certain someone and find out everything she knows about this. After that, we'll decide how we're going to proceed.
Clark held the note close to his face to look at the last scribble down at the bottom of the page. After a few seconds, he nodded, then tossed it on the table.
Hazelton's last note tells us there is trouble ahead, boys.
The others looked the note over. It was clear to all of them. DPRK. Sam took the words out of the others' mouths.
I hate those guys.
The Gulf Stream flew northeast toward the dawn, the four men in back trying to catch as much sleep as possible, because to a man they expected the events of the previous evening were merely the beginning, and more trouble lay ahead.
Chapter 6. 1 year earlier. For as many of the 28 years Choi Ji-hoon could remember, he had been surrounded by those who told him he would someday lead his nation. Most of those people were sycophants, though he'd never heard such a term. He knew these people only as unimportant. Still, he believed them. He believed them because his father, the only person who mattered, had told him the same thing. Choi Li-hung explained to his son, Choi Ji-hoon, that someday he would die, and when that happened, young Ji-hoon would replace him to become the supreme leader of North Korea. Ji-hoon's father promised his son he would rule, but he did not reveal to his son that he had absolutely no faith in his ability to do so. Choi, the father, thought his son to be weak and lazy and not exceptionally smart, and he considered him the biggest sycophant of all. By the age of 22, young Ji-hoon had become a party official, and his one duty involved traveling around North Korea commissioning works of art to commemorate historical events in the nation. Ji-hoon turned this job into a vehicle by which he could suck up to his father. Every single painting and statue Ji-hoon ordered created was of Choi Li-hung, a blatant way to curry favor and earn his succession. But Choi, the father, felt he had no choice. He did not want to bequeath his nation to one of his brothers. They all had sons of their own, and Li-hung refused to allow his nephews to lead the DPRK, for the cynical reason that by doing so he would decrease his own legacy to future generations. His other children were all daughters, and it was out of the question a woman would lead North Korea. This left succession to Choi Ji-hoon. The weak and lazy one was the only heir suitable to reign over the nation. He knew his son would not be a good steward of the DPRK, but in the end, continuing the authority of the bloodline, and therefore his own immortality,
was more important to Choi Li-hung than the lives of the 25 million citizens under his rule. Choi Li-hung did little to prepare his country for his son's reign. His one nod to his son's incompetence was his insistence that Ji-hun take power with 6 of Li-hung's advisers as his personal counsel. These men had been with Li-hung throughout his 20-year rule. One of them, his foreign minister, was a brother. Li-hung knew putting remnants of his regime in his son's administration was no substitute for a competent supreme leader, but he thought it might save the nation from the utter destruction Ji-hun might cause on his own. And then it happened. When Choi Ji-hun was 27 years old, his father died, and he became the supreme leader of North Korea. At first, his 6 advisers effectively ruled while Ji-hun reveled in his newfound power. Power brought on not only by his job title, but by the fact his father was no longer around to scrutinize his every move. Ji-hun spent money even more lavishly than he had before. New statues and paintings all bore his own face now. He commissioned parks and sports stadiums and monuments in his name, and he smuggled in luxury goods by the shipload, even while famine raged across the rural reaches of the DPRK. But Choi Ji-hun changed in the months after his ascendancy. He grew less interested in debauchery and more consumed by a paranoia brought on by all the attention on him. On the 1-year anniversary of his father's death, Choi Ji-hun decided he needed to assert his own authority, to exert more control over all matters of state. Nothing to him was more important than his relationship with the military, because they held the key to his survival. While his father had been called Dear Leader by his subjects, Choi Ji-hun demanded to be called Daewon-su, or Grand Marshal, signifying him as the commander of all armed forces in the nation. Although he'd spent no time in the military other than a 4-week white glove program for the sons of party leaders, his biography was quickly rewritten, claiming him to be a bomber pilot who'd safely crash-landed a crippled aircraft on a highway to save his crew, and a special forces paratrooper who had led 33 covert missions into South Korea to rescue North Koreans kidnapped and sold into slavery in the South. These exploits were taught in schools, songs were written about the events, and television and radio documentaries featured interviews with his supposed fellow soldiers and airmen. That every bit of the Daewon-su's military history was bullshit was never uttered by anyone who knew the facts, because those who knew the facts also knew that the fiction was more important than the facts, and maintaining the fiction would be done at the expense of the lives of anyone who disputed it. Ji-hun's father had been no dove. Hardly. Li-hung had killed tens of thousands of his own countrymen through executions and imposed famine, and he brought the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war multiple times by firing artillery on South Korea. But Choi Ji-hun distinguished himself by becoming even more hawkish. He pushed for the purchase and development of new weapons systems, and he ordered provocative training operations on the border. He test-fired missiles that flew over the sovereign territory of his neighbors, and his Korean Central Television station broadcast threats to South Korea, the United States, and Japan on a near-daily basis. Ji-hun's muscle flexing did not just take place on the world stage. As he grew into his role over time, he exerted more and more domestic power, and he took that power away from the 6 men his father had left behind. Any pushback by the 6 was seen as a direct menace to his reign, and Ji-hun's growing paranoia about threats at home and abroad all but made it inevitable he would eliminate his council of advisers. Within a month of this decision, 5 of the council had been executed for myriad imagined crimes against the state. Getting rid of the 6th man, however, had proved more difficult. Choi Sung-yu was Ji-hoon's uncle and a 70-year-old diplomat who had served as his father's foreign minister. After his father's death, Ji-hoon made Sung-yu ambassador to China, a step down from the nation's top diplomat, but still an important posting, especially considering China's close relationship to North Korea. The two nations were allies, though less so now, because China had been frustrated by young Ji-hoon's saber-rattling. The last thing China wanted or needed was a destabilized Korean peninsula, after all. So China's relationship with its neighbor had cooled precipitously. Other than some trade with China and a few other nations on a much smaller scale, the economy of North Korea was effectively closed. 95% of all goods produced in the nation were created by state-owned firms. Still, China was the North's largest trading partner, and China had no greater industrial influence than in the mining sector, because it had long been known by the Chinese that North Korea's real value lay under its dirt. Everything changed in the relationship between the two nations when a group of Chinese geologists working in North Korea revealed they had found deposits of valuable rare earth minerals in the mountains in the northwest of the nation. The North Koreans had hundreds of mining contracts with the Chinese. Together they dug coal, iron, silver, and nickel. But this rare earth find was exceptional. The geologists dug test mines, and their proclamations became more and more optimistic. Finally, it was decided by the Chinese that the world's largest find of rare earth minerals, some 213 tons in all, was likely buried near Cheongju, under the rolling hills of Pyeonggangbuk-do province near the coastline of Korea Bay. The Chinese state-owned mining company was given rights to develop the deposits for 25 years. The paperwork was signed, and they began building up the infrastructure in the area necessary for the work. And then, after 1 year of hard but productive work, Choi Ji-hoon ordered his uncle, the ambassador to China, home for consultations. He explained to his uncle that the newfound wealth the Chinese had promised was all very well and good, but the Chinese had something that was even more important to North Korea than wealth. Ji-hoon's uncle was confused. "What do they have, Dae-won-soo?" "They have the technology we need." The uncle brightened. "Yes, all the newest drilling equipment has been brought in already. The computers that maximize productivity are being installed as we speak. When the mine goes online next year, we will..." "I am not talking about mining technology, uncle. I am speaking of missile technology." "Missiles?" "Of course. The Chinese have been reluctant to share with us their expertise for mid-range and long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. I want the expertise. I want North Korea to develop its own domestic long-range rocket industry, and China is the key to this." Ji-hoon's uncle nodded slowly, looking off into space as if he were intrigued by his brilliant nephew's scheme. "Are you saying we only continue the rare earth mining partnership if China supplies us with ICBMs?" Choi Ji-hoon said, "Exactly that, uncle." The uncle had known his nephew for his entire life. That he had to couch his words carefully to him, just as he had his brother, was still odd, but he knew what was good for him. "I think this is wise and shrewd diplomacy on your part, Dae-won-soo. I only wish the Chinese shared your brilliance. I am afraid that the Chinese diplomats are unrealistic, and they might jeopardize the lucrative mining operation if they refuse our reasonable request." Ji-hoon waved the comment away as if it were a trifling concern. "You have excellent relations with the Yongte." It was a derogatory word for Chinese, akin to calling them chinks. Ji-hoon's uncle fought back a wince. "You must see that they do not refuse, uncle. The negotiations happened in Pyongyang. Several of China's top leaders came, hats in hand, ready to offer almost anything to continue the rare earth mining contract with North Korea. Almost anything. When Choi's negotiators explained the Chinese contract would be invalidated if they did not provide the DPRK with a ballistic missile manufacturing center, including the materials and the expertise to run it, the Chinese went home to Beijing, spoke with the Central Committee in secret, and returned. They offered more food, more money, more conventional weaponry, marine military technology on par with China's own navy. They offered expanded trade rights and better terms on China's processing of the rare earth minerals after extraction. They offered high-profile diplomatic official visits by the Chinese leader to increase North Korea's cachet on the world stage, and they extended invitations for Choi to come to China as a guest of the president. But Choi had not been raised in a manner conducive to producing a diplomat. He'd been given virtually everything he wanted since birth. Those around him knew crossing him could be punishable by death. He was, therefore, a truly awful negotiator. He was intractable, inflexible, and impatient. Choi rejected it all. He wanted the means to deliver a nuclear device to the United States. In his mind, it was the only way to be safe from attack and assassination. China refused to allow the DPRK access to the technology to create their own long-range ICBMs. It wasn't that China was trying to protect the United States, far from it. It was simply that China realized what North Korea would do once they had the most dangerous and most valuable bargaining chip in international affairs. They might or might not use the device, but the death of millions of Americans in nuclear fire was of lesser concern to the Chinese than the certainty that the ostracized pariah North Korea would exercise their newfound power on the world stage recklessly and threaten the region. The destabilization of the Korean Peninsula was hardly in China's self-interest. 1 month to the day after the negotiations for the Chongju mine began in Pyongyang, the Chinese were notified that every Chinese national at the mine had 72 hours to leave the country. The executives of Min Metals and Chinalco, China's state-owned mining operators, tried to reason with the North Koreans, but no North Korean official dared read any flexibility in Choi's demand where none existed. The Chinese at Chongju rushed out of the country, leaving much of their equipment behind, though the Chinese geologists and engineers had done a remarkable job getting as much of it out of the DPRK as possible. The open pit mine went dormant overnight, despite Choi's demand to the director of the government's mining arm, Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation, to keep the mine open and operational. The truth was, the North Koreans had neither the equipment nor the know-how to operate a rare earth mineral mine on their own. On top of that, the Chinese had taken their generators with them, and the power lines into Chongju were inadequate for the operation. The director of the mining concern explained all this calmly and carefully to Choi Ji-hoon, and this candor benefited him greatly. He was only thrown into a labor camp. He wasn't executed. There was one more piece of fallout from the Chinese rare earth mine negotiations. Choi had decided that his uncle, North Korea's ambassador to China, had not been an honest broker in the affair. He held him personally responsible for the breakdown in negotiations with the Chinese, although it was Ji-hoon's own uncompromising demands that had doomed the negotiations. His uncle, his father's brother, a man who could have ruled the DPRK had the cards been dealt differently, was relieved of his position and thrown into the internment camp at Chongjin in the northeast of the nation. Chapter 7. Present Day. President of the United States Jack Ryan stepped out of the Oval Office while slipping on his suit coat. He passed through his secretary's office and entered the adjacent cabinet room as he fixed his lapel and straightened his tie. In front of him he found a dozen men and women already waiting for his 3 p.m. meeting, and they stood as he appeared. But he waved them back to their seats quickly as he sat down at the head of the table and reached for a cup of coffee already positioned there for him. His wife Kathy wasn't crazy about his afternoon cup, but his blood pressure had been so good during his last checkup he'd successfully negotiated 5 ounces of black Jamaican light roast 5 days a week. And Ryan was especially proud of this diplomatic coup. He looked around to confirm the attendance of the usual suspects for most meetings involving national security. Secretary of State Scott Adler, CIA Director Jay Canfield, Director of National Intelligence Mary Pat Foley, National Security Advisor Jolene Rubilio, and Secretary of Defense Bob Burgess all sat near Ryan at the northern end of the table, and farther away, more men and women of the military, intelligence community, and Department of State sat with papers and tablet computers in front of them. Also in attendance was Arnie Van Dam, Ryan's chief of staff. Arnie wasn't a national security official, but he, more than anyone else, had the president's ear, and he had the president's stopwatch. He had a lot of control over who got FaceTime with Jack Ryan, and for this reason Ryan wanted him in important meetings of national security so Arnie could have an understanding of the stakes and give those involved in any crisis the access they needed to the chief executive. Ryan had heard of other presidents being slaves to the agendas written up by lesser chiefs of staff, with the Girl Scout who sold the most cookies for the year getting more attention than an Undersecretary of Defense on a day when a world crisis loomed. Ryan did his share of low-priority meet-and-greets, but he had no problem shooing away the Girl Scouts when he needed to give his attention to an impending catastrophe. This meeting had been on the schedule for a few days. Originally, the topic had been a series of aggressive troop movements in Russian-held eastern Ukraine, but Ryan had been given the heads-up this morning that the troubles in Central Europe would have to take a back seat today in favor of an even more pressing crisis. Ryan caught himself wishing the problems he faced on the world stage would all line up and approach in single file, but he'd been involved in government work for decades, and he knew emergencies preferred attacking simultaneously along a wide and coordinated front. Ryan had learned through experience that good leadership meant staying versatile, flexible, and ready to put out fires as they flared, and the last-minute change-up that had been called for in today's meeting was just one more example. He'd also learned to do his homework. He wasn't walking into this meeting unprepared. He'd spent most of the last hour reading through national intelligence estimates and briefing books, and even some raw intel on the crisis du jour. Intelligence intercepts had determined days ago that North Korea was fueling a long-range rocket, a version of its most advanced ICBM, and moving it to its launch pad. They were clearly prepping to launch, likely for a test because their earlier launches of the device had all been unsuccessful. This new test had, quite understandably, caused concern at the White House, and Ryan had been boning up on the North Koreans' technology before the meeting. As soon as Ryan sat down, he said, "I got word the agenda for today's meeting has been changed, so I guess that means the DPRK launched." SecDef Bob Burgess nodded. "Yes, sir." Ryan sighed. "Give me the details." "Colonel Richard Ward from DIA will brief us, Mr. President." A tall, thin Army colonel in his 40s stood up at the far end of the table. In his hand he held a laser pointer, and in front of him was a folio with the seal of his organization, the Defense Intelligence Agency. Sitting next to Ward, a female DIA major controlled with her tablet computer the map and graphics on a large plasma screen on the far wall. The screen showed the entire Korean Peninsula at first, but quickly it zoomed in on the DPRK. Ward said, "Good afternoon, Mr. President. At 2200 hours yesterday North Korean time, some 6 hours ago here in Washington, the DPRK launched an Unha 3, or Galaxy 3, rocket from their Dongcheongdong launch station in the northwestern part of the country. This facility is also known as a Sohae satellite launching station. The screen next showed the 100-foot-long rocket. As you are aware, sir, the DPRK claims the Unha 3 is a space launch vehicle, and while this is technically accurate, it is merely an expendable carrier rocket, and therefore virtually identical to the DPRK's most advanced but as yet unproven ICBM, the Taipodong 2. Ryan did know all of this. The colonel seemed a little eager and earnest, not intentionally patronizing his president, but perhaps unaware of the fact Ryan made a point to know as much of this material as possible as part of his job. Ryan waved a hand. Right. Any sat launch over there is just cover to test an ICBM. The Unha 3 is more than big enough to carry a nuke, and the range estimates say it could deliver a payload as far as Northern California.
That's correct, Mr. President. If the North Koreans have successfully managed to miniaturize a nuclear device, we haven't been able to confirm they have perfected the technology yet, but we suspect they have. The Unha 3 carries a 100-kilo payload, and you can pack a lot of power into a 100-kilo device if you have mastered the technology to miniaturize it.
Or if you have stolen the technology, Ryan said. The colonel nodded, though he looked a bit off balance by the comment, because it wasn't part of his briefing.
Please continue, Colonel Ward, the president said. The screen now showed a graphic representation of the launch and the separation of the first stage of the rocket missile.
We had a number of sensors in place to track the launch, measurement and signature intelligence assets. From this, we have put together what happened after the rocket cleared the launch pad. The first stage burned for approximately 2 minutes. Burnout took place at 120 kilometers altitude over the east coastline of North Korea, above the city of Tanshan, and there was good separation. The second stage burnout occurred at 350 kilometers over the Sea of Japan. The rocket then apparently malfunctioned before third stage separation. There was a catastrophic failure, and it crashed into the Sea of Japan 80 miles west of Sapporo.
Ryan was more than pleased by the failure, but he knew the diplomatic fallout from Japan would be near equal to the nuclear yield of the device if it had been armed. Scott Adler was thinking the same thing.
I'm sure Tokyo isn't too thrilled about the wreckage coming so close to their mainland.
Jay Canfield replied, I'll bet they're pissed. As far as I'm concerned, though, that's better than it plowing into Seattle or San Fran.
Ryan continued to address Ward. Any idea what went wrong?
Mass Int, that's measurement and signature intelligence, detected an abnormal flare after second stage burnout, but before separation. We will be running tests for some time, but it looks like it was something we call a staging failure. It is not uncommon, especially for the DPRK. The last time they launched an Unha 3, they lost it at first stage separation. So this time they got a little further.
What was the duration of the flare? Ryan asked.
The colonel was obviously surprised by the question. He looked down to his sheet, then quickly began shuffling papers in front of him. The major sitting at her iPad scurried a bit as well, before finding what she was looking for. She pushed a page to Colonel Ward.
Sorry for the delay, Mr. President. The flare lasted approximately 2 seconds.
Ryan made a face.
That sounds a little short to be a staging failure, doesn't it? Normally, with stage fail, there will be a partial flame-out before the explosion. This, to me, sounds like an instantaneous detonation. Maybe the ground control center saw the rocket wasn't going to make it into orbit for some other reason, so they aborted. Just pushed a button and blew the ICBM up in flight. Does the Unha 3 have a flight termination system?
Colonel Ward looked at some more papers.
We actually do not know the answer to that, Mr. President. Their mid-range ballistic missiles do not have flight termination systems, but this ICBM is much larger, so we think they might.
They might? Ryan asked. This wasn't the kind of intelligence briefing he liked getting, and from the look on Ward's face, this wasn't the type of intelligence briefing the colonel liked giving.
I'm sorry, sir. We don't have any hard intelligence that answers the question one way or the other.
The Russians have flight term systems on their mid-range and larger ICBMs, and so do the Chinese, right?
That is correct, Mr. President.
Well, the North Koreans are basing their systems off of Russian and Chinese technology, so it should follow they have a similar setup.
Ward did not reply.
Yes or no, Colonel Ward?
Well, yes, but...
But what?
But the North Koreans have taken significant shortcuts with other aspects of the systems they copy. It's possible they did not put any flight termination systems on their UNHA-3. We just cannot make a determination with the raw intel we have on the matter.
Ryan was dissatisfied, but he changed gears. Okay. For some reason, the missile failed. Let's talk about what happens next time when it succeeds. Where are we on determining the efficiency of their nuclear weapons?
Ward thought he was on firmer ground here. They have a stockpile of around 50 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium, most of which is dispersed in the existing weapons. They also have uranium enrichment facilities. They have one overt facility at Yongbyon, but we're virtually certain that is just a cover location to show their interest in uranium is for peaceful purposes. They have other clandestine facilities, but the location and efficiency of these are uncertain.
He frowned. Another function of our poor intelligence out of the country.
Director of National Intelligence Mary Pat Foley chimed in.
The most recent nuclear test performed in North Korea, we think, used uranium and not plutonium, and if this is in fact the case, it shows us they are expanding their capabilities. They've had three successful underground tests. They've got a plutonium bomb. That is not in doubt. We estimate they have between 5 and 10 devices. The yield is in question, but suffice it to say they are big enough to pose a threat.
When Foley finished, Ward picked back up. As I said before, DIA speculates the DPRK has reached the sophistication for miniaturization of their nuclear weapons to the degree they could, in theory, place a small plutonium-based warhead on one of their Rodong missiles, with a range of 1,000 kilometers. If this is in fact the case, it isn't too far-fetched to think they could weaponize a longer, intermediate-range rocket.
Ward hastened to add, we do think the targeting of the missile would be inaccurate and the efficiency of the warhead to be low.
Ryan asked, how low? What is the estimated accuracy of the Type 02?
Undetermined. There is a 25% probability of...
Ryan interrupted. Are we talking accurate to within a few miles? Tens of miles? Hundreds of miles? Just a general idea.
Ward looked back down to his page.
Ryan sighed. Colonel, you are being too careful. We're just two guys talking here. We didn't bring you in to read the damn paper in front of you. I can read it myself. I need to hear what you know and what you think.
Ward cleared his throat.
Yes, sir.
We think the Type Odong 2, if successfully deployed, would be accurate to within 25 to 50 miles.
Secretary of State Adler broke in now. It doesn't have to be accurate. It's a terror weapon, an instrument of blackmail. Choi isn't after a tactical advantage. He's after money, power in his region. The world's worst nuclear bomb on top of the world's most inaccurate ICBM still scares the hell out of a lot of people.
Ryan nodded.
Me? For instance.
Me too, Adler admitted. Still, it's important to remember what's going on here. The entire North Korean nuclear industry isn't some wacko plot to destroy the world. It's a wacko plot to earn the respect of the world.
Ryan said, I agree with that, but I wouldn't characterize it as wacko.
North Korea's GDP falls right between those of Kenya and Zambia. If we only had economic factors to consider and not military factors, we wouldn't be spending any more time concerning ourselves with Pyongyang than we would with Lusaka.
Chief of Staff Arnie Van Dam glanced up from the papers in front of him with a look of confusion.
Capital of Zambia, Arnie, Ryan added. Arnie nodded and looked back down. Ryan said, "The DPRK already gets more attention than they would warrant if they didn't have a nuke, but they want to be treated with all the deference of the other nuclear weapon-holding states. Frankly, once they have a working ICBM that can hit California, I'll be forced to give them that respect." Ryan turned his attention back to Ward. "So, to recap, we know the rocket failed before third stage. We don't know why, but we're looking into it." Ward replied sheepishly, "Yes, Mr. President. Unfortunately, that's where we are." "Okay," Ryan said. "Thanks for your report." The two DIA employees looked to Mary Pat Foley, who nodded at them and then turned her gaze toward the door. Ward and the major packed up their briefcases and started heading out of the room. Ryan called after them. "Colonel, Major." They both spun on their heels. "Sir?" "You did the best with what you have. The fault wasn't the messenger's. I just need more to the message." "Yes, sir," the two DIA analysts said. "And next time you come back, be ready for a discussion, not a presentation. You'll find I'm pretty easy to chat with when I'm engaged. You guys have the knowledge, and I'm just about the most curious son of a gun you'll ever meet." Another round of "yes, sir," and the two left the room. When they were gone, Scott Adler smiled. "That colonel looked like a recruit just off the bus. Did you see the deer in the headlights look he gave you when you asked for the flare duration?" Jack shrugged. "I guess I went a little overboard. I've been reading a lot of our primary intelligence on the DPRK's systems. Frankly, I was hoping there was more intel than what was in the reports that make it to me. There are a hell of a lot of holes in our knowledge." CIA Director Canfield said, "You can't get too deep in the trees, boss. You were the one everybody relies on to see the entire forest." "Yeah, I know." Canfield added, "Mr. President, it's important for you to understand why there are gaps in our knowledge of North Korea. Our SIGINT, ELINT, and MASINT are all fair to good. We have spaceborne platforms, airborne platforms, surface platforms, and even subsurface platforms, and they are all pointed at the Korean Peninsula. We have cyber platforms too, of course. But our HUMINT is lacking. Most of the human intelligence we have comes from defectors to the south. They are usually of poor quality. Subsistence farmers, laborers, teenagers who make it over." Jack said, "You were saying we are in the dark." "From a human perspective, we are nearly that. We have some low-level government officials in our pocket, but the ones in Pyongyang we do hold some influence over are not able to communicate with us regularly, if at all. We don't have a single CIA-run government asset in the entire nation. Even at the absolute height of the Cold War, we always had agents in the Soviet Union. But these days we are dark in North Korea." "Okay," Ryan said. Then he drummed his fingers on the table. "Getting back to this failed launch, I wish we could all celebrate. But the problem with North Korea..." He held a hand up quickly. "One of the problems with North Korea is that bad news for them is not necessarily good news for us. We've all seen it before, right? They respond to an embarrassing failure with a flexing of their muscles. Saber-rattling." Mary Pat agreed. "Their long-range missile blows up during second stage SEP, so they test-fire 24 short-range missiles into the Sea of Japan." SecDef Burgess said, "Or they shell islands or send mini-subs south of the 38th parallel." Ryan added, "The new Choi has been going out of his way to show us he is to be taken just as seriously as the old Choi." The National Security Advisor said, "Mr. President, may I be the voice of perspective here? Even with all this taken into account, the DPRK is not our main problem right now. Even if there is some new low-intensity conflict on the Korean Peninsula, there are other, more pressing issues going on in the world. I think we need to count our blessings they still can't hit California with a plutonium bomb, and then return our focus to Russia, NATO,
China, the Middle East, and all the other more critical issues out there.
Jack nodded and rubbed his eyes.
Why can't all the assholes out there just take a number and threaten us one at a time?
There were stressed chuckles around the room.
So, what do we do about this?
Adler said, I suggest we go back to the Security Council, push for another vote condemning the DPRK.
The UN?
Seriously.
To what end? Ryan asked.
China will just veto. Russia too.
Adler shook his head now.
China and North Korea aren't the allies they used to be. Now that Choi the son has taken over for Choi the father, his destabilizing is pissing them off in Beijing. Remember China and DPRK had that big blow-up over mineral rights last year? We won't get a vote from China, but it's possible we'll get an abstention.
National Security Advisor Rubilio added, Russia will veto, but it creates another attempt to isolate Russia diplomatically. With a new resolution, we can marginalize Russia and censor North Korea. Kill two birds with one stone.
Ryan answered back, that's not killing two birds with one stone. That's yelling at two birds as they fly on by without a care. Russia will keep doing what they're doing, and Chairman Choi doesn't give a damn about condemnation in the Security Council. His focus is on holding and exerting power, nothing more.
Adler was unwavering. The UN might not have teeth, but the sanctions against the North are already as strict as we have any hope of making them without some dramatic new development. Diplomatically speaking, there is little we can do.
He looked across the table at SecDef Burgess. Unless you're going to send Bob to attack Pyongyang, Mr. President, a UN resolution is about the only weapon we've got.
Ryan dropped his elbows on the table. Even with the broad sanctions on their weapons development programs, conventional and nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, they still manage to launch ICBMs and detonate nukes. The Chinese don't want them armed with nukes any more than we do, so we know they aren't supplying them. Russia is the one adding fuel to this fire.
Canfield agreed.
That's right. The Russians don't care if North Korea has a nuke. It's another headache for us to deal with, and the DPRK pays in cash. There are only two impediments to North Korea having a deployable ICBM.
And those are? Asked Ryan.
One, the sanctions. Russia doesn't want to get caught sneaking banned items and technology into North Korea, because that hurts them diplomatically. They do it, but they do it carefully, and that means the technology comes in a slow trickle.
And the other?
The other, quite simply, is money. North Korea is a hopelessly poor regime, with very little hard currency in the West. If they suddenly found themselves flush with cash, they could up the ante with Russia and unscrupulous private defense contractors and command a lot better service. Russia will sell them anything at any time. If the DPRK ever starts waving around hundreds of millions instead of millions, you'll see the proliferation increase precipitously, and they will get an arsenal of ICBMs.
Jack put it succinctly for the rest of his national security team. A poor DPRK is in U.S. national interests. We can't go out and say it to the world, because we'll be accused of starving the citizens of North Korea, even though it's the government of North Korea that's starving its own people. But we have to do whatever we can to prevent Choi's government from flourishing financially.
Mary Pat said, violations of sanctions allow millions in wealth and goods to trickle in and out.
Jack said, we've worked for two generations to bleed them dry so they would come to the bargaining table, and still they keep moving on. We need more intelligence out of the North. He looked to Mary Pat and Jay.
This is a critical need. I know you have 1,000 other things to deal with, but after that DIA brief, it is clear to me we aren't going to have a solid handle on DPRK's capabilities until they demonstrate their capability by dumping a payload onto San Francisco. At that point, it will be too late to do anything about it. I want you to improve your humint in the DPRK.
The meeting broke up minutes later, and Mary Pat Foley stood from her chair, ready to return to her office at the Liberty Crossing complex in McLean, Virginia. Her president wasn't satisfied with the intelligence product he was getting, which meant she had a hell of a lot of work to do. She'd meet with CIA Director Canfield and discuss it, because they were both feeling the same heat. She had just left the cabinet room and collected her mobile phone from a wicker basket on the president's secretary's desk when the device vibrated in her hand. She answered it without looking.
Foley.
Mary Pat. It's Jerry Hendley here. Foley stepped into the West Wing hall. She could tell by Jerry's tone of voice something was wrong.
What is it?
Are you where you can talk? Mary Pat looked around. Men and women walked all around her. I'll be back in my car in a few minutes. I'll call you then. Just tell me this. Is this about Colin Hazelton?
Yes.
Is he okay? Jerry sighed into the phone.
No. No, he's not. I'm afraid he's dead.
She stopped fully in the hall, her knees weakening in shock as she did so.
Dead?
Chapter 8. 1 year earlier. The office of the Supreme Leader of North Korea is the Ryongsong Residence, also called Residence Number 55. It is located on a small lake in the northern suburbs of Pyongyang, and it serves as one of 10 private residences for the nation's ruler. The compound is several miles square and surrounded with fencing and gates. The living facility is hardened for conventional and nuclear attack, and two brigades of elite troops reside on the property with the sole mission of protecting the Supreme Leader both from foreign armies and domestic insurrection. A black limousine arrived at the compound's outer perimeter checkpoint at 10 a.m. Armed guards checked the driver and the occupant in the back, a small, thin, 54-year-old bald man in a gray suit. Soon the limo drove north through the hills of Ryongsong, stopped at more checkpoints along the way, until finally the vehicle pulled up to the entrance of Residence Number 55 itself. The bald man climbed out and was led with his small entourage into the building. Then he was brought into an ornate sitting area by three female assistants of the Daewonsu, and he sat down on a straight-backed chair. Tea was placed in front of him, and a second cup was placed on the empty sofa on the other side of the table, and left empty. He sat nervously in the silence, concentrating with all his might on giving off an air of calm. The man's name was Hwang Min-ho. He was the new director of the Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation, the nation's state-owned mining concern. In his position for less than a week, he was here to meet Choi Ji-hoon. This would be his first face-to-face with the leader of his country, and the current occupant of the center of the personality cult to which Hwang had belonged every second of his life. Both of Hwang's parents had been on the personal staff of a colonel who served as a deputy of the Workers' Party of Korea, his father a driver and his mother a nanny for the children, and they were both typically fervent believers of the propaganda upon which the entire society was based. Hwang was raised to revere not the party or the government, but the leader of his nation, a benevolent god who created all and bestowed all his blessings upon his people. Choi Ji-hoon's grandfather, then his father, and now Ji-hoon himself, they had all been the epicenter of Hwang's universe. Hwang never questioned the things he knew to be truth. His leader's perfection and omniscience were established facts, as sure as the rising and the setting of the sun. That said, Hwang was worried about his new promotion. Hwang saw what happened to his boss. He'd done his difficult job to the absolute best of his ability. The Daewonsu had demanded the impossible, and when the impossible was not delivered, Hwang's boss was taken from his home. The rumor at the state-run mining company was he'd been sent to Kyohwa So No. 9, the notorious re-education camp on the east coast of the country. The urbane 60-year-old former director of mining was, if the rumors were true, now working on his hands and knees in a coal mine
and subsisting on a cup of barley soup a day. Hwang himself had been ordered to remove every single mention of the former director from Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation literature, to erase the very existence of the man. He did as he was told unquestioningly, and he did not even doubt the Dae Hwan-soo's decision internally. As a boy, his mother had told him the leader of the nation could read his mind, so to always project love and gratitude in his thoughts. But Hwang, though brainwashed, still was a sentient being, so when he was ordered to fill the former director's position, he could not help but recognize this great honor came with great danger. Hwang thought of the danger now as he waited in the luxurious sitting room at residence number 55, especially when two armed men, both dressed in the olive-green uniforms of the Chosun Inmingun, the Korean People's Army, stepped into the room. They were armed with AK-47 rifles that hung over their shoulders, and they took up positions near the doorway. Four more men entered and stood behind the sofa in front of him. Hwang knew these men were members of Section 5 of the Party's Central Committee Guidance Department, and they were the Dae Hwan-soo's personal bodyguards. Still two more men, both wearing Mao suits, entered. These appeared to be personal secretaries of some form or another. Soon, Choi would enter, and Hwang knew the reason for the meeting. Choi would tell him his decision regarding foreign partnerships at the rare earth mineral mine at Chungju. Since the Chinese had been thrown off the project weeks before, there had been discussions to bring them back, if not as co-equal partners in the project, at least as foreign contract employees. Hwang's staff had sent over all the relevant facts and figures about what was required at Chungju, and the information obviated the fact that the mining operation did not have a chance for success without outside help. He fully expected the Supreme Leader to come to the same conclusion. A female secretary in the uniform of a Chosun Inmingun major entered with a transcription machine. She set up her operation on the chair next to the sofa opposite Hwang. When her machine was ready, she bowed to Hwang, and he bowed to her. Everyone greeted one another as Dongmu, comrade. Everyone stood or sat silently and waited like this for more than 30 minutes. Hwang was ready to wait even longer, but when a beautiful female attendant entered through a side door and poured steaming tea into the cup across from him, he knew the Dae Hwan-soo was on his way. No one would dare serve the leader of the nation tea that had grown cold. Seconds later, Choi Ji-hoon entered through the massive double doors into the residence, flanked by four older men in military uniforms. Hwang had seen his nation's leader numerous times before. As an elite of North Korea, Hwang often found himself at functions where the supreme leader appeared. As always, Hwang was taken by the man's young face and the wide cut of his impeccable black Mao suit. As Hwang leapt to his feet, his placid face morphed into one of unbridled joy. He bowed over and over as Choi approached, but he did not speak. This was the way to greet the Dae Hwan-soo, and Hwang was damn well not going to mess it up. The military men took positions against the wall. In their hands were notebooks and pens, and they smiled at Hwang, who bowed in their direction. He was careful to form his bows to appear gracious and subservient, but not as deep as those reserved for the Dae Hwan-soo. Choi smiled back and sat down across from Hwang. He reached forward and took his tea and sipped it silently for a moment. He looked around the room with bright but furtive eyes, as if making sure everyone in his entourage was in place. After a few moments, he looked to Hwang. Dongmu Hwang, someone said your father drove for Colonel An. Hwang's heart leapt, and his eyes fought back tears of joy. Both of his parents were still living, and he knew telling them the Dae Hwan-soo knew something of his father's life would bring them outrageous happiness. He bowed from his chair and struggled to keep his tone measured. Yes, Dae Hwan-soo. You are correct. You bring great honor to my family by speaking of him. But Choi had already moved on. The Chinese will not be returning to Chungju. We will continue on without them. Huang knew every relevant fact and figure on the subject. North Korea was abundant in many valuable natural resources, but due to acute shortages of electricity, it would be impossible to exploit the mine without help. But if not the Chinese, then who? Brazil had some joint mining ventures here in the north, but they didn't have the rare earth experience China did. Huang knew Chungju would never have been discovered without China, and the exploitation of the find wouldn't happen in his lifetime without outside help. Huang did not say anything upon hearing his leader's decision. Choi cocked his head, as if noticing the delay in the response. If he took it as any sign of disrespect, Huang knew, he would be executed. Dissent was punishable by death, and dissent was highly subjective in the DPRK, to say the least. "You disagree with my decision?" Choi asked. Huang recovered quickly. He bowed. "No, Daewonsu, of course I very much agree. I am only thinking of the difficulty with the mine at Chungju. We have been partnering with the Chinese at most all of our mineral extraction sites, but at Chungju we rely on them." "That reliance was a mistake by your predecessor. I told him it went against Juqi. He has been punished for allowing China to outshine us technologically." Juqi was the North Korean philosophy of self-reliance. This, and the worship of the Choi's, were the quasi-official religions in the nation. Huang said, "Yes. Yes, of course, I agree." "Good. But? "We can extract the ore. Obviously, our nation has the best mining capability in the world." Huang wouldn't have gotten anywhere in his career without calculated exaggeration, but this was an outright lie. "But the actual processing of the rare earth minerals has always been done in China." "What do you mean, processing?" Huang was confused by the question. It had all been in his report. He said, "The ore is mined at Chungju, then delivered by truck to China. The three minerals containing rare earths, bastnasite, monazite, and xenotime, must be identified and put through a grinding process, and then different chemicals are applied to the powder so that the rare earth oxides will separate from the other minerals. This is a highly technical process that requires geologists, chemists, computers, and computer experts, and others." Choi said nothing. Huang asked, "Will we continue to ship our ore north to have it purified?" "Of course not. We will do all this here. Not only do we have the largest reserves of minerals on the planet, we have the best scientists and the best technology with which to exploit these minerals." Huang forced himself to nod. Not only did it seem as if Choi was ordering Huang to create an industry where none had existed before, but he was also demanding he adopt a process no one in North Korea had even seen firsthand. Choi looked up at the military men around him. Huang did not know why, but he did not like the silence. To break it, he said, "We will develop the processing capability." He added, "We will lead the world." Choi smiled now, and Huang thought the meeting was about to end. Instead, Choi said, "Very well. I will give you my guidance to ensure everything goes smoothly. Now, you might wonder how long you have. This mine will generate great riches for our nation, and we need these riches to ensure our national security. Having said this, I do not want to rush things, because I know this will require some work on your part." He looked up as if thinking and said, "I demand you to begin profitable mining at Chungju within..." It looked to Huang as if he was going to pick a time frame out of the air. though he didn't seem to be even remotely aware of the complexity of the endeavor, or even what rare earth mining and processing entailed. Huang knew that other nations had taken decades to produce their rare earth mineral industries, but he doubted Choi would give him that long. He hoped to at least hear him say 10 to 15 years. Instead, Choi said, within 18 months. The bald man's heart sank, but he managed to keep his visage the same other than a slight trembling of his lower lip. The task before him was impossible, but he knew there would be no discussion in the matter. The Dai Wan Su had spoken. Huang loved the Dai Wan Su. Both the state and his parents had successfully brainwashed him into doing so, and he did not question his devotion to Choi. But even so, he knew Choi's words to be madness. After only the slightest hesitation, Huang Minho said, "Yes, as the new director of Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation, I promise you we will meet with great success in the endeavor." He added, "And we would be so honored for your continued advice." Choi nodded with a smile that made him look genuinely pleased with the talk, and then he stood. Huang stood quickly himself and began a routine of beaming grins and bows, a show of utter subservience that was only enhanced by the fact he fully expected that the man in front of him would order him sent to a labor camp in exactly 18 months. Chapter 9. Present Day. Jack Ryan Jr. awoke in the pitch dark, his eyes thick with sleep and his mind void of any clue of where the hell he was. He heard rain pounding on a window next to him, and he thought back, tried to remember the recent past. "This feels like jet lag. Where did you go this time, Jack?"